Okay, let's get started here with the Gospel of Luke, chapter 5. It starts with the call of the apostles, fishers of men. And one of the common points that you'll see in that point about fishers of men, as opposed to like hunters of men or trappers of men, or we could come up with all sorts of, when you get the fish in the net, the idea of using a net is that you're not damaging the fish. You're getting them all together. Yeah, they can't get away, but you've got them in this net. And the contrast, the kind of the helpful contrast that you'll see is they'll talk about how it is with fish. Of course, the fishermen, they're catching them, they're going to sell them, they're going to eat them. But the idea here is that you are not taking living things now and killing them. If it's the opposite. You are bringing people in who are in some way dead and now giving them life. So that as opposed to the consuming the fish, it's like you're reviving the fish. So that's an important difference, and there's a fittingness in describing the apostles of fishers and men. Lapide, the Jesuit commentator of the 1600s, talks about how it is that, you know, in the call of Peter, and remember the church gets this term, the bark of Peter, that the Peter and then his successors in the papacy, they are supposed to be, as it were, the head evangelist. They are supposed to be the head pastor, and pastor in the sense of going out and bringing the nations to the church. That's one of the principal things that a holy father is supposed to do, and you see that in the call of Peter. In reading that, I was reminded of Pope John Paul II's Novo Millennio Innuente. Novo Millennio Innuente is some in English. You'll see it at the dawn of the new millennium, and this was I'm trying to remember if it's a post-synodal apostolic exhortation. I think has that term. It's not an encyclical letter. It's this kind of letter that you have after you've gotten a bunch of your bishops together and you've talked things out, and now you put out a document. In any event, at the dawn of the new millennium, he opens that document by quoting Luke, right? Duc in altum, go out into the deep. And for Pope John Paul II at the dawn of the new millennium, that's his exhortation, not just to the bishops, not just to the clergy, but even the lay faithful. Go out into the deep. In other words, be zealous to evangelize. Be zealous to bring people to the church. Be zealous to share this wonderful truth that the triune God and that Christ Jesus has brought to us. One of the more memorable passages of this document, Dawn of the New Millennium, is where he's talking about holiness. And it's in the section where he's talking about pastoral planning. Now, if you've ever been involved in parish work, like you've been on, you know, committees in the parish or in the church or whatnot, maybe even that expression, the word pastoral planning, it just has a soporific effect. It has a tranquilizing effect. In general, when you talk, in fact, about committee, doesn't the very word committee work just start to drain the marrow out of you? Just hearing this phrase. So it was a refreshing thing in this section of Pope John Paul II when he talks about pastoral planning, pastoral initiatives. He starts by saying, I have no hesitation in saying that all pastoral initiatives must be set in relation to holiness. Okay? It is necessary to rediscover the full practical significance of Chapter 5 of the Dogmatic Constitution of the Church, Lumen Gentium, dedicated to the universal call to holiness. Okay? At first glance, it may seem almost impractical to recall this elementary truth as the foundation of pastoral planning. Can holiness ever be planned? What might holiness mean in the context of a pastoral plan? And he goes on to explain. As the council itself explained, this ideal of perfection must not be misunderstood as if it involves some kind of extraordinary existence possible only for a few uncommon heroes of holiness. The ways of holiness are many according to the vocation of each individual. I thank the Lord that in these years He's enabled me to beatify and canonize a large number of Christians. And among many lay people who have attained holiness in the most ordinary circumstances of life, the time has come to re-propose wholeheartedly to everyone this high standard of ordinary Christian living. Just think about that line. The high standard of ordinary Christian living. Okay? It's also clear the paths of holiness are personal and call for a genuine training in holiness adapted to people's needs. Okay? So when you see that passage, right, go out into the deep. On the one hand, yes, that implies that you are going out to people who don't believe and now bringing them to belief. But I think the other thing that you can see in that call of go out into the deep, even for yourself, right, that you don't settle for, as John Paul II calls it, a kind of mediocre Christianity, right, that there's this high standard or extraordinary standard of ordinary Christian living, and that if we have in our parishes, in our schools, if we settle for anything less than holiness as a goal, all of it's going to end up being frustrated. You know, it's going to go nowhere. For those of you who are old enough to remember, in the 70s and 80s, it was almost like the message of the council was that somehow we were all going to lead things. We're going to have all these lay committees. We're going to swarm the sanctuary and the altar with extraordinary ministers. We were going to be heads of committees. We were going to be all these empowered lay people. But I think of this wonderful person, now departed. He died years ago of cancer. But Earl Mederi, he was a professor of theology at Viterbo down in La Crosse, and he told me that he was a cantor at his parish, and at one point his pastor came to him and said, "You know, Earl, you do so many things around the church, but really, Earl, I'd like to empower you." And Earl, in response, said, "Father, thank you for the offer, but I'm already empowered. I'm baptized. I've been confirmed. I've received my first Holy Communion. I'm empowered." Right? In other words, that you are living a sacramental life. That's the foundation for your empowerment. Empowerment is not that you're a greeter at the front of the room or that you're carrying out all sorts of various roles. It's the graces that God has given you so that you can grow in holiness. That's the most fundamental form of empowerment there is. Okay, so to go out into the deep, not just go out into the deep, evangelize, but to seek greater personal holiness. That's the call to be, as John Paul II says, the call to be baptized. When you say, "I wish to be baptized, I wish to receive the sacraments," what that means is, I wish to be holy. To wish to enter into a sacramental life is to enter into holiness. That's what the sacraments are about. Let's take a look at this next section, the healing of the leper. While he was in one of the cities, there was a man, and notice this phrase, full of leprosy. Other gospel writers will talk about him being a leper, but it's Luke the doctor who will describe, as it were, the extent of the disease, that he's full of leprosy, presumably visible on his face. When I was a kid, my father was on a research trip to Australia. So we lived in Sydney for 5 months. Randwick was the neighborhood we lived in. I went to Australian public schools, Randwick Elementary. So I had the gray Oxford shirt, tie, dark gray sweater, and the gray short pants. And you could tell us from the Catholic kids across the street, because they had blue Oxford shirt, tie, dark blue sweater, and the blue short pants. Okay, so that's why when I listen to kids complain about uniforms, blah blah blah. You get out of the United States. Lots of countries have uniforms. It's absolutely normal. In any event, on the way back, We hit a bunch of countries on the way there, and we hit a bunch of countries on the way back, because this is like a unique opportunity. So one of the places that we were in was Jakarta in Indonesia, the capital city in Indonesia. And I remember being in a cab, and there was this woman begging on the street. And there was something about it that just looked strange to me, and then the cab kept going. And I looked at my father, and I said, "What was wrong with that woman?" And he told me, her nose was just melted away. She didn't have a nose. And I said, "Probably that looks like leprosy. That's probably leprosy." So, you know, this was like, what, 1974? but there's still leprosy out there. And, you know, that's what it does. It rots your extremities, tips of your fingers, your toes, and like a nose. That would be something that would rot away. And it smells. You know, that was the other reason why they kept lepers away, because it's essentially rotting flesh. And notice the amazing thing here. He stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, "I will be clean." I mean, there were... You didn't touch lepers. In fact, when you go back to, that's the reason I put here, 2 Kings 5, this is when Elisha cures Naaman. And when Elisha cures Naaman, like, Elisha's in this cave, and he doesn't even come out of the cave. Basically, the servant shouted at him, you know, "Naaman's here, and he wants to be cleansed from leprosy," and Elisha shouts back, "Have him wash in the Jordan 7 times. And Naaman is all bent out of shape about that. "I thought he would come speak over me," and basically he has to be persuaded to go wash in the Jordan. Aren't there rivers in Syria that are better than this? But he does as he's told. He washes, and he washes 7 times, and then you're told his flesh is as a little child's, right? His flesh is completely restored. But even then, Elisha doesn't, like, come out. So in the Old Testament, even when you have the curing of the leper, there's like no physical interaction. Whereas Jesus, when he cures the lepers, there are times that he simply speaks the word of command. But you have these lovely moments where he reaches and touches this person who in this society is just considered untouchable. Okay, I'm reminded, of course, in this passage, I think about last year when we were under lockdown. And, you know, we got the kids in masks, and we got them spaced and whatnot. But just when you realize how starved they are for physical affection, yeah. How starved they are, that once you remove those things, I mean, they're like puppies. You know, they're all on top of each other. And think of how the pain of being a leper and just really being deprived of physical contact. Nobody's going to, like, come up and give you a hug, or, you know, no one's going to do that. No one's going to want to get close to you. And that Jesus would reach out and touch him. There, I think especially in light of our recent experience, you can have a better sense of how meaningful that would be when, in fact, ordinary human contact would be denied you. Ordinary human contact would be denied you. We have the story of him healing the paralytic. This is a story that is told in Matthew, in Mark. There is, I think it's Mark that has the most detail, if I'm remembering right. In any event, so you hear this story several times. But the key thing about the episode, whether regardless of which gospel you're reading it in, he heals the paralytic. The Pharisees object, before he heals him, you know, he forgives his sins, you know, and that's really what they... Who can forgive sins but God alone? And that's when he works the miracle. So the miracle is connected to this power to forgive sins. So the key line in this whole episode... But you may know, verse 24, but that you may know the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. So in other words, the point of the miracle is that you understand that I am who I say I am, that I have the authority that I claim that I do. Yeah, I could just say your sins are forgiven. There's nothing visible that would show that I have the authority to do that. But by what power am I able to tell this paralytic, take up your mat and walk? And that's going to happen. I had a class night at St. Thomas, and one of the questions that came up, because I was explaining how it is that God does not work miracles, of course, all the time. He sets up a natural world and he lets it work. You're not just as we're going to govern the universe by miracle. What is the point in creating natural things with their own respective powers and so on if you don't let them work? And I had the excellent question or kind of objection, well, but aren't miracles a kind of overriding of that? In other words, why would it be right to have miracles if really you are going to set up a natural world and let it work? Well, especially you can see here in the context, Jesus works this miracle. Yes, it's something supernatural, but does that supernatural power, as it were, radiate out and compel everyone to accept it? The key thing that you see in that episode is the human will is still freely at work. That human will is still freely at work. These people who, the paralytic and his friends, they're grateful. There are people in the crowd who are rejoicing. We have seen wonderful things today. They are rejoicing. The Pharisees are, you know, almost like the old-time silent movies. They're like Snidely Whiplash. They're like the villain. Curse is foiled again. They're as irritated as ever. So in other words, if you have the idea of miracles sort of overriding nature, in the sense of overriding the human will, no, that isn't how they work. It is an overriding of nature in the sense that this guy is by a supernatural power being allowed to walk. And yeah, so his nerves, his muscles, all those things that weren't working for him, yes, that has been overridden. He is now able to walk. There's an overriding of nature there. But that overriding of nature is for the sake of the range of responses, and to speak more, perhaps more precisely, to strengthen the faith of those whose faith is able to be strengthened. You know, there are people who are going to respond to the miracle with openness, and ultimately the miracle is for them. Think last week when we were talking about not working miracles in Nazareth. He didn't work many miracles there. And one of the observations that Cornelius Lapide makes, Father Lapide makes, is, well, in a way, it's knowing that they aren't going to respond well. It sort of reduces their condemnation. You know, at the point where you work all these miracles and they just refuse to get it, it's like they become more culpable. So you're not, in other words, you're not always doing a favor to folks by lavishing them with miracles. If their response is simply going to be negative, you're now just increasing their responsibility. I came to you, I laid it out for you, I showed it to you, and you were still just, right? Not your thing. You're not my idea of a prophet, and so on. Next, we have the call of Matthew. And one of the things that's unique in Luke, he leaves everything. Okay? And remember, this is, I have up there, tax collector, customs house. When you look at the word that's translated, the Greek word is telones. And telones, when it's used in the Jewish context, could mean either one. It could mean a tax gatherer. This is somebody who the Romans would contract out, and almost like your personal income tax. And then there was the customs house. And in other words, when you're bringing things from out of town, they like go through your bags and, okay, that's taxable. And they would always be trying to get as much out of you as they could. They were always trying to squeeze you. So these people were particularly disliked. I mean, not that anybody's crazy about the IRS, but remember that they don't get a higher salary by squeezing more out of you. Do you know what I mean? They get their standard government salary, standard government benefits. These people they're outsourced. Do you know what I mean? And so they are giving to the Romans a percentage of what they collect. So their incentive is therefore to collect as much as they can because they keep whatever it is, 5, 10, 15%. Okay? So their incentive is just to find as many things as in your bags as they can tax and get. So if you're not wealthy as a customs house, guy or a tax collector, you know, you're not doing your job. You know, you should be doing pretty well on this. For the sophomores in the moral theology unit, in the moral theology, when we talk about wealth and poverty and greed and generosity, I find that the passages that I tend to use the most come out of Luke, because Luke 12 gives me the guy who he has an abundance and he has this great idea. I'll pull down my barns and build bigger barns. I will say to my soul, soul, you will have abundance in the future. Eat, drink, you know, be content. And that's when God intervenes. Fool. Ouch, that hurts. To whom shall all this wealth go? Okay, that's Luke 12. It's Luke 16. You have the unjust steward. You know, to dig I am unable, to beg I am ashamed. And it's also in Luke 16 that you get the story of the rich man and Lazarus, right? The rich man who feasts sumptuously every day. There, in other words, there's an attentiveness to the attractiveness of wealth and the comforts of wealth, the allures of wealth, more in Luke, I think, than in the other Gospels. And so perhaps that's one of the reasons why it emphasizes that Matthew leaves everything, that this is something that's possibly a snare for him, what's holding him back. And when he hears the call, he goes. I have to think that, you know, we don't have any background, but I have to think that Matthew or Levi, he's already got some kind of discontent, that once our Lord comes along and calls him, it's like a trigger. You know, finally he has the call, and he drops everything and accepts it. If you've ever seen the documentary on Mother Teresa that's done by the Petrie sisters, it's about 90 minutes long. A lot of it is footage of Mother Teresa, you know, doing her work in India and elsewhere. But there's a point where they're interviewing these, you know, lovely 20-year-old girls who are missionaries of charity. And one of them, I remember, she was English. And she went to college. She had a job. She was a literary agent. And she said, I had friends, I had a car, I had a business account, I had a good life, but there was something in me that was dead, that wanted to live, but was dead. And when I read about Mother Teresa, it came to life for me. And she said, when I told my friends, they were so shocked, they were so disappointed, they wanted me to see a psychiatrist. You know, if we just get you into counseling, I'm sure this can be remedied. I'm sure we could do something about it. But that was the way she talked. There was something in me that was dead, that wanted to live. And you have to think something like that with Matthew here. He's very successful. He's very wealthy. You're not doing your job as a customs officer. You're not. And that he responds as quickly as he does. There must be some kind of discontent, some kind of yearning beyond it, that once he hears the call, he leaves everything. I want to talk a little bit about the fasting here, because after they have this, the apostles of, or disciples of John, verse 33, and they said to him, the disciples of John fast often and offer prayers, so do the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours eat and drink. Okay, and notice that phrase, fast often, that there's regular, evidently, fasting that's a part of. Not the requirements, not under the Jewish law requirements. There's only one day, Day of Atonement is the only day on the books that you're required to fast. But the Pharisees, for example, that's why I have my little note to myself, Mondays and Thursdays, because Thursday was the day that that Moses went up to, I think he went up to the mountain, Mount Sinai, on a Thursday and comes down on a Monday. You know, so there you remember these days. Of course, Thursday is the evening of the, you know, before the Sabbath. So is that preparatory before the Sabbath. In any event, there are these 2 days that were habitual or customary for them to fast. John the Baptist, remember, he's out there living on locusts and wild honey. So not a surprise that his disciples are fasting. But the disciples of John complain. You know, why aren't you guys fasting? They're not going to fast while the bridegroom is with them. That's how Jesus describes himself. I'm the bridegroom, so it's not fitting that they fast now. But later the bridegroom will be taken from them, and they will fast. I have had students in the past that are high schoolers that the whole idea of fasting, and fasting as a regulation, is just perplexing to them. Sometimes these are people who come from an evangelical or non-denominational Christianity where fasting is not a part of their religious experience. But also, you can have a number of Catholics that this is just not anything that they've really grown up with. It's not part of the parish life. I was describing scrupulosity and laxity. You know, we have a unit on conscience, so I'm describing the difference between scrupulosity and laxity. And scrupulosity, of course, not just being strict, but being hyper-strict. They've recently had the example of Luther in their history classes, so I will refer to him. You know, Martin Luther was somebody who really felt overwhelmed by his own sin, that there are all these sort of requirements and rules, and I just can't follow them. And I said, that's what scrupulosity does. You squeeze yourself, and then there's just this kind of collapse. Small sins look like big sins. Even things that are sort of like bad thoughts or tendencies look sinful to you. You're just overwhelmed. Laxity is the opposite. So things that are big sins to you look like small sins. And things that are relatively small sins don't seem like sins at all. Okay? Now, the reason I tell them this is because not just to understand these two terms, but if you are going to have an upright conscience, to some degree, you have to be aware of the tendency of your own age and your own time. Arguably, if you were growing up Catholic and you were Irish in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, the Irish tended to be in the United States and in Ireland tended to be on the strict side. They tended to be on the scrupulous side. There's a history behind that that goes back to the immigration of Jansenist priests from France to Ireland. When the Jansenists got kicked out of France, that was one of the places they fled to, was Ireland. So there is this infusion of kind of like Calvinist Christianity or Calvinist influenced Christianity in Ireland, and then that comes to the United States. Okay? So if you were growing up in those kind of communities, there could be a kind of a hyper strictness, which then you would, if you were going to have an upright conscience, you were going to have to sort of bend the stick to them. You were going to look a little loose. But in an age that you're growing up in, you are not growing up in a scrupulous age. You are growing up in an age which is much more on the lax side. So if, in fact, you have an upright conscience, you are going to look to the people around you too strict. Okay? You are going to look to the people around you too strict. In general, when you are at some kind of moral extreme, the middle looks extreme to you. If you're a coward, the brave man looks reckless. And if you're reckless, the brave man looks like a coward. If you're scrupulous, the person who's in the right spot is going to look loose to you. If you are lax, the person who's in the right spot is going to look too strict. Okay? And, you know, now how do you know? I mean, one of the ways you know is by just having an awareness of kind of that history of Christianity. Being able to get out of your own time, out of your own culture, and have some kind of basis of comparison. If you're just, you know, stuck in the bubble of your own time and your own place, then you don't really have a basis of comparison. So one of the things I used as an example was fasting. I asked them, how many days are you required to fast? As a Catholic during Lent, how many days are you required to fast? Well, most of them didn't know, but some of them remembered 2 days, Ash Wednesday, Good Friday. Okay? And I said, the Christian practice, you know, going back centuries, these were people who fasted all 40 days of Lent. All 40 days of Lent. So it wasn't 2 days out of Lent. It was every day. Okay? What days are you supposed to give up meat? Right? And they know that it's Fridays in Lent, but that you can give up an equivalent sacrifice, whatever that means. And I said, okay, but you have to remember that in Christian societies, again, for centuries, you gave up meat all 40 days of Lent. That's why there was Mardi Gras. That's why there was Fat Tuesday. This was the last day that you could have meat or meat products, like the fat. That's why in the Spanish-speaking world there was Carnival. That was the, again, that week and a half period. This was the last time that you were going to be able to have meat for the next 6 weeks. OK? Okay? So in other words, you can look at your own time in comparison to these great, you know, stretches of centuries across the history of Christianity and really have a sense that we're kind of pampered, that we have a very, very low bar in terms of how it is that we challenge ourselves in terms of penitential practices. So that's the kind of thing that allows you to say, I am more likely to be leaning toward laxity than to be leaning toward strictness. And it's not to say that you couldn't be in pockets and bubbles here and there, you know, a parish, a large family, that there aren't little pockets of where you could be hyper strict or scrupulous. But I almost feel like, you know, if you find genuine scrupulosity, I mean, these are people who need to be captured and studied. It is in the modern church that's just kind of tough, and it's something that, by the way, has been a trend of the century. When you read, let's say, when you read Leo the 13th, when you read Pius the 11th, Pius the 12th, they will talk about the comfort, the self-indulgence of the modern age. And they're writing long before cell phones, household appliances, computers. They're writing before that. Because, of course, the great increase in standard of living is something that happens not just in the 1950s, but really at the end of the 1800s, going into the First World War. Yeah, go ahead.
When did it switch where we didn't have to fast from midnight on for Holy Communion?
The 50s.
Before Vatican II.
Before Vatican II. There were things that were already shifting in the 1950s.
So it switched from midnight to an hour?
I don't know that it was an hour right away, but it started to be loosened. Yeah, it started to be loosened. It started to be loosened in the 1950s. And there are a number of these things which individually or taken by themselves, you can give a kind of a reasonable defense of them. The problem is once you start multiplying them, where the whole trend has been relaxation, there's nothing that gets stricter. There's nothing that's more demanding. If I were to move to a different area, think of Holy Days of Obligation. The tendency of the American church is to keep pushing them on Sundays. So now we have the spectacle of Ascension Sunday. And you've broken up by celebrating the Feast of the Ascension, not on Thursday, but on the nearest Sunday. Now what you've done is broken up the original novena. The original novena was the 9 days in preparation for the Feast of Pentecost. At some point, that pendulum will probably swing back. But the difficulty or the challenge is, especially if you're younger and this is how you're being formed, you don't have the sense that you're really, that anything is really being asked of you or demanded of you. Think of just all, you know, compare the demands that you have. If you're going to be a serious student and you're going to college, think about the demands that are on you if you're in a sport, if you're in a varsity sport. And then when it comes to your religious life, there isn't all that much demanding. It's harder to take something seriously if there aren't serious expectations. That's just harder. And again, especially when you're young, because where people set expectations, That's a message to you about what's important. And if there aren't expectations, then you send the message, whether you intend it or not, that this really isn't all that important. That's what the kid walks away with. That's why it is that even though, in an already challenging schedule, you know, a lot of our religion classes for these high schoolers are pretty challenging. Because what I've seen is when you look at these other schools that have these, what else can you describe? Powder puff religion classes, the kids have a contempt for religion. They don't respect it. They don't respect it because I go to chemistry, there are things I'm supposed to learn, I'm supposed to get down this periodic table, I'm supposed to balance equations, I go to math, there's a quadratic formula, I'm supposed to be able to apply it, I'm supposed to be able to understand it. I go to religion, and now the teacher's up at the front of the room, yeah, there's Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but what's your gospel? What's your story? What's your version? Now, if you think I'm making that up, I'm not. That's my sister. My sister went to a Catholic school just like that. And it's one of the reasons, not the only one, but one of the reasons that she's not practicing today. My sister tells me, why is it when I go to math, I'm expected to understand a quadratic formula? When I go to chemistry, I'm expected to discuss a periodic table. But I go to religion, and suddenly I'm the expert. Suddenly, I have my own gospel, or I have my own revelation, or I have my own truth. That's discouraging. That's demoralizing. In any event, the larger point I want to make here in the question of fasting, fasting is something that is you see it in the Old Testament, and it's going to be continued in the New Testament. And yes, there is this time that the apostles are. They're not fasting when they're with Jesus because they're with the bridegroom. But afterwards, what are they told? When you fast, do the following. And it's the reading we hear at the beginning of Lent every year. Don't draw attention to yourself in your fasting. But very clearly, you're being told to fast. And the reason you're being told to fast, along with all these other penitential practices, they're all ways of freeing ourselves for a spiritual life. If you're attached to the body and to bodily comforts and having things just so, it's harder to open your heart to things that are spiritual. The point of a penitential life is not just, we're just going to suffer. We're just, we're going to have a glue, pull a long face. No, it's you are liberating yourself from those comforts. Think of how it is. If you're used to comforts and you don't get them, think how put out you are. Right? Oh, my shower isn't warm enough. The car isn't heating up fast enough. My phone, I'm not getting service. Right? If, especially in a high-tech world, it's like everything is supposed to be at your fingertips, or you are one unhappy camper. And that you are able to deny yourself, and deny yourself about very basic things. You are not then as tied to all those comforts that in the modern world you're just surrounded by. You're just surrounded by all the time. It is freeing. It's liberating. And by the way, going back to the kids for a moment, think of what a challenge it is for them. Because I think of the difference. Just think of, so you could choose one of many. But, when I was growing up, you had to get up and walk across the room and change the channel on the TV. And I think it was around the time I was a teenager. Remember, why were the remotes invented? They were invented for hospital patients. That's why the remote was invented. You had hospitals, and you wanted to be able to have people change the channels. And now we're all in hospital beds, essentially, sitting there on the couch, right? Remote. And that's the idea that somehow you would go across the room and turn a channel. The work involved in that. If you're old enough, you remember that when the knobs would break off, you would have to get the pliers, and you'd be running around the house looking for the pliers or the antenna. You had the rabbit ears because the antennas weren't working, and the rabbits, and you'd be getting coat hangers and like putting these coat hangers or aluminum foil. You tell a 15-year-old that, and they think that you are living in the Middle Ages. They think that you are living, was the car invented then? Or they think you're living in... But all of those things, they're all things that make life easier. But the problem is, if you're just surrounded by things like that, that are just continuously making life easier, you just become soft. There's that spiritual depth is harder to acquire, because in a way it's like you're having to wage war on almost everything around you, because everything around you is just trying to make you just a little more comfortable, make life just a little easier for you. Well, very good. For next time, Gospel of Luke, chapter 6. Have a good week, everyone.